Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ira Glass and Judge LaDoris Cordell.
Come on, Ira. Good evening and welcome everyone to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club, California. My name is LaDoris Cordell, I'm a retired Superior Court judge, and I'm delighted, really delighted to be your moderator for tonight's program. Joining us tonight is Ira Glass, a titan of public radio. Ira's show, This American Life, has over 2 million listeners every week. And Ira's new role is being producer of the Netflix film Come Sunday. So we're excited that Ira's here tonight to discuss the film and the journey this real-life story has taken since he first reported it over a decade ago. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ira Glass to the Commonwealth Club.
Nice to be here.
Welcome, Ira. I'm very excited about our conversation. I'd like to do three things tonight. I'd like to talk a little bit about This American Life, then about the film Come Sunday, and then I find you so fascinating, I'd like to talk a little bit about you.
Okay.
Yes.
You're in charge. I will lead where you follow.
That's wonderful. Thank you,
Judge.
So This American Life was created in 1995.
Yes.
And I believe you're up to 630-something episodes?
Yeah. Jeez. Something like that.
And that wasn't the original name of the program, right?
Yeah, no, the original name was Your Radio Playhouse.
And
I just thought, like, it sort of as a callback to like, sort of radio drama, Radio Playhouse, and then also it was a little shout-out to Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh, yeah.
In his pre-masturbation in public days. Which honestly is anyway yes yeah and then we changed the name. We changed the name partly because the program director in Los Angeles said she, like, before we even were trying to distribute the show, she heard a copy of the show. Just somebody played her a tape of it, and she's like, "We want to run this. We know you're not offering it nationally, but we want to run it now. But you have to change the name because we already have a show called NPR Playhouse." Oh. And then she suggested that we call it, she's like, "I've got an idea, it should be called Glass House."
Glass.
And I was like, "I don't want a show with my name in the title."
Ah, yeah.
I counter-proposed Glass Hole. and she said no to that. And then we moved on to other names. And like, I've never thought This American Life is a great name. I thought it's like it's okay, and now everybody's used to it in the same way that everybody got used to my voice. So it seems like, well, that's the way it should be. But like,
you can't change it now.
Can't change it now.
Can't change
stuck
it
with it.
So the topics on The American Life vary. Actually, they're all over the place, right?
Yeah.
You got, you know, from Hurricane Katrina. There was kids' logic about how kids think. There was a Brahmin bull named Chance. And then you have the black preacher who wrestles with a whole lot of stuff that we're going to talk about in a little bit. So how do you get these stories? What's the process?
I mean, it's like sometimes there'll be something that one of us gets just very interested in. And a lot of the best stuff that we do comes from that. Like for the last 2 years, Zoe Chase, one of our producers, has been just obsessed with the changes in the Republican Party. And so in the year leading up to Donald Trump being elected, you know, it was just like covering what was going on in the party in a very aggressive way and very innovative way, and like got in with people in a great way. And like a lot of stories have come out of that, or you know, just like somebody will get obsessed with something. But a lot of it is just very, very random. Like we stumble across stories, somebody hears something from somebody else, people pitch a story, random people write to us. And a lot of the trick to making the show is that we actually start in production on way more stuff than ends up on the air. Mm-hmm. Like for every two or three stories that end up on the air, we probably look at 10 or 12 and go into production on five or six.
Do you want people to write and suggest stories?
Sure.
You do?
Do you have a story?
I got a lot of stories. I mean, I was a judge for 19 years. I got plenty of stories, right? So you had a brief foray with This American Life into television.
Yes.
How did that work? Did it work
out?
I
mean, it was a success, like, on paper. Like, the network was happy. We were on the Showtime network. We were on for 2 years. We won a bunch of Emmys, and the audience was really good, like, a large audience from their point of view. But we discovered, like, I feel like we were always kind of more special as a radio show than we were as a TV show. And then there were certain things about making the show as a TV show that made it much harder to do stories at the level of quality that we wanted. Like on the radio show, most of the stories happen in the past. Like, it's rare that we'll just, like, go to a place and camp out for a month and record what happens. Like, occasionally we'll, like, you know, one of my favorite episodes, we went to one car dealership on Long Island and just watched for a month as they tried to make their monthly quota. And so it was very much real time happening in front of the microphones. But most of the things we're doing, it's very traditional journalism where we hear about a thing.
But who came up with the idea of going and watch a car dealer? I mean,
Rob and Semi, one of our producers, bought a car from this dealership. And there's something about the way that they interacted. She's like, they're competitive with each other, but they're really funny and they're good talkers. It's just like, it's just got a nice vibe.
It's like Seinfeld. I mean, you just pick something and you just...
Well, I will say, like, usually it doesn't work. Like, usually when we head down... No, like most of the things we try don't work. Like right. By far, like, three-fourths of them, more. Huh. Like most of the interviews we do don't work. Like, most people don't talk as well as people talk on our show. You know, like...
Got it.
Even with editing, we can't make it work. But this was a situation where she was... She's an amazing person and producer, and, like, her instincts were really good, and we went there and then we said to them, the only way we'll do this is if you'll really open up the books and let us see how much you make on each car and what the money really goes to. And the guy who ran the dealership has been in the business for 30 years. He's like, yeah, sounds fun, sure, whatever, yeah, fine. Wow. And so we really knew, like, we really understood, like, when somebody was getting a good deal, or when they only thought they were getting a good deal but they were totally getting screwed. It was really wonderful. Like, it was really good for drama to be able to fact check, to be able to look at the spreadsheet and tell.
Oh, my God.
And it was really true that at the end of the month, people were getting much better deals. And then this particular month, they were so desperate to make the quota because they hadn't made the quota the month before, and they get a huge chunk of money from the car company they're part of. They were Jeep Chrysler, and they get so much money that it's the difference between them being in the red or the black for the month. So they really had to make the quota, or people were going to lose their jobs, for real. Yeah. And like, by the end of the month, the guys are calling, like, their nephews and nieces, and they're like, you're buying a car. I'm going to put down a down payment. That's my fake New York accent.
It's
very authentic. It's a character I'm working on.
So several of your episodes have been acquired by filmmakers Spike Lee, Warner Brothers, yeah, Paramount Pictures. The episode, The Fix Is In, inspired Kurt Eichenwald's book, The Informant, mm-hmm, and then the movie, The Informant, with Matt Damon.
No, the book came first, I have to say. Book? Like, our radio episode was a cover version of his book.
Got it.
But then the screenwriter Scott Burns and Steven Soderbergh heard the radio episode and bought the rights and made it into a movie.
Oh, wow. So with Come Sunday, you're the producer.
Yes. Yeah, this is the fourth film made from the fifth film made from a story from our show, fourth one we've been involved with.
And this film had its world premiere at Sundance.
Yes.
And it's released on Netflix just a few days ago.
Right.
Right. I watched the film. I loved the film. It really touched me in a lot of different ways. And can you tell us about the episode, tell us about the film, and how you got stars like Martin Sheen, Danny Glover to be in the film?
I mean, the episode is about this minister named Carlton Pearson, a person who was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a rising star in the evangelical movement. Just this weekend, we reran the radio episode from 2005 that we originally did, and he had preached at the White House a couple times, and for the Bushes and the Clintons, was even on TV. He started the South by Southwest, the gospel music South by Southwest called Azusa. And it was just like this. He had a mega church, an integrated mega church in Tulsa, which is a really big deal to get people different colors to be in a church together.
Because Sunday's the most segregated day of
Dr.
the week,
King,
right?
Dr. King said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And it was Oral Roberts' protege. And then God revealed to him that everybody gets into heaven, not just people who believe in Jesus. And then he started to preach that. And then just things go very badly for him. And the reason why we wanted to make it into a film, or we thought it could be a good film, is partly because it was a story with the scope of a film. Like it really is like a very traditional sort of old movie where a man at the top of everything, you know, who's at his height of his powers and headed for better things, like sort of takes a stand on principle and loses everything. You know, like loses his friends, loses his fame, loses his fortune.
Loses his church.
Yeah. And has to choose if he's going to keep preaching what he was preaching and, you know, just has to choose. And it seemed like it had, and then the fact that it was about a theological question that was interesting to a lot of people, that's sort of around and resurfaces every few years when somebody like Rob Bell, you know, leaves the Pentecostal movement or Carlton, you know, every few years, it seems like there's somebody who comes out. And then the other thing for us is that even before making this film, back when we were still doing the radio, doing the story as a radio story, like we had been on a tear for a few years where I wanted us to do more stories about Christians. And
why?
The way,
why?
Because I had observed when I got in my 30s, I got close to a bunch of people who were evangelical and still believers, and I felt so aware of how different they were from the way that Pentecostals are portrayed in the news and in the movies and on television. First of all, like evangelicals were at the time were like a fourth of the country. I mean, it's getting smaller, and they're aging up. But it's fourth of the country, and I feel like when they appear on the news or in movies or TV, like they're just these cartoons or these sort of like stiff-backed, doctrinaire, like uncomplicated, like they're people who aren't grappling with their faith in the way that I think most people do, and the people who I knew who were evangelicals, to a person, took very seriously Jesus's admonition and to love everyone and really took seriously, like, just they were subtle. I mean, that's the best way I could say it. Like I just felt like there was a huge gap between the way that evangelicals are portrayed and the evangelicals who I knew. And I thought, like, well, that's an interesting thing to document. I felt like this is really, like, in a way, like as somebody documenting life in this country, one of the things we look for a lot is what's a group that's just not represented well and you don't hear the real story. And weirdly, to say, like, Christians. It's like, it turns out Christians. And then we just did a series of stuff where I went with kids on their missionary trip. And I went with, you know, just we did like a bunch of stuff where I just thought, this is just really interesting. And for me, growing up Jewish, like, it was a world I didn't know, and I felt I really liked the evangelicals who I got close to and I met when in my reporting. I felt like they were almost to a person people who organized their lives around ideals, which I relate to because I feel like I do too. And I felt like I had in a certain way, like, a lot more in common with them than I do with a lot of other people, weirdly. And so I thought it would be exciting to try to make a movie that secular people and Christians would both go to. And one of the things that was interesting to us was to make the movie in a way that evangelicals wouldn't stay away, because, like, we didn't want it to be a film arguing for Carlton's position,
right?
Partly because we didn't want evangelicals to stay away. We wanted them to engage with the material. But partly because, just from a story point of view, if the people who oppose Carlton aren't sympathetic, it's not an interesting drama. You know what I mean? Like in the film, we take pains to make sure that his best friend, Jason Segel's character, like, is kind of a great guy, you know, and really reaches out to him with love to say, like, brother, I wish what you were saying was true, but, like, it's not in the book, and I'm scared for you. Like, I don't want you to go to hell. Like, I don't want your wife to go to hell. Yeah. Like, I'm scared for you. And for Oral to reach out to him like a dad with a son.
Right.
And so for all those reasons, it just seemed like an interesting project. And when we tried to, it took 7 years to get the funding together because I actually had phone calls with studio heads of the traditional studios, and they were just too scared of people picketing them.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because they would say all of them would say, like, I don't know anything about religion. Like, I don't know anything about Christianity. These are secular people, many of them Jews. And... but some of them are not. And they're just saying, like, I'm not an expert on, like, what's going to get us picketed. Like, I don't want to have to worry about that. It just seemed like, you know, your main character says that the way that everybody reads the Bible is wrong. That seems like it could be problematic. And we would say, we would explain to them, no, no, no. But the whole point is, like, it's going to be a whole movie inside that world. And we feel like people will like that who are in the church. And also, like, they're going to get a fair, they're going to get a fair shake. Like, they're going to see their side totally represented in a fair fight against this heretic.
Has there been any picketing?
No picketing. Now, in fact, when we show the film, like, the, we've shown it now a bunch of times, and at every screening, like, we did a screening in L.A., and it was 800 people, and the people who came up to us afterwards who were the most excited were the people who were either evangelicals now or they were raised as evangelicals.
So you deal with gay issues in the movie, yeah, too, right? Do you want to say anything about that, or just let people watch it? And
I think that people, I mean, like the storyline, the music director of in our film, the music director of the church, played by Lakeith Stanfield, who's such an amazing actor. He was in Get Out. He's in Atlanta, which is the best thing on TV. It's such, like, you just feel like they're inventing a whole aesthetic for a thing. But anyway, so that's based on a true story. And it seemed like a good story to include in the movie, partly because when the screenwriter was talking to Carlton, it was a story that had meant a lot to him and tested his faith. Because once he's saying you don't go to hell, he really had to deal with, like, well, what about all these people who you think are sinners? Should they stop sinning? And then he had to examine, did he really think that was a sin? And then also he had kind of a business problem, which was he didn't have anybody to preach to. And so maybe these people who had been rejected by the church, he could preach to them. And somehow, like, those things all kind of came together in an interesting way.
Wow.
And so, and then it, yeah.
Do you have more films you think you're going to do?
I mean, we have a bunch of things in development. And there've been, for 15, 20 years on the show, there've been always been, like, a whole bunch of them in development. And most of them, nothing ever happens. like they would just, you know, like we'll be working with incredibly wonderful filmmakers. And, you know, the guys who'd made the Lego movie are trying to turn Serial into a TV show, and Mike Mills, who made 20th Century Women, we have a project with him that actually looks like it's probably going to happen. And, like, but, like, for years they don't happen. Most, Glenn Shelton, we have a project with, who's an incredible director, has a new movie out that's so wonderful. But, like, most of these things, they never happen, just, like, because it's millions of dollars, and I don't know, man.
But did you... I really encourage everybody to watch this film, because there's so much going on in it, and the acting is just off the chain.
The actors are just really, it's a really magical thing to turn
up.
I mean, I didn't go to set or anything.
You didn't?
No, I was super involved in the writing of the screenplay, because it was so similar to organizing a radio piece, but, like, I have nothing to contribute on the set.
So screenwriting is similar to writing for radio?
Not the actual writing dialogue, but just, like, thinking through the plot points. Where do you start? Like, how do you pull people in? How do you make somebody like a character? Like, all those things are the things that we ask when we're making a radio show. Whose story arcs do we want to stay on? Like there are all sorts of decisions. Like, how long do we want Carlton to be at the bottom before we bring him back up? How much time do we want to spend on the marriage versus the other stuff? Like, there's just a lot of just purely dramaturgical questions, which are exactly what we ask when we're doing a show like last week's show or 2 weeks ago show, where Zoe Flake is following around, Zoe Chase is following around Senator Jeff Flake for 4 months as he's trying to pass DACA. And you really have to think about, like, how do we make people bond with him and side with him and question him at other points? And like, what are the scenes? When do we stop the scenes for a moment of reflection? It's just it's a lot of, like, dramaturgy.
Wow. Could we talk about you a little bit?
You're in charge.
I love it. So your dad was an accountant.
Yes.
Your mom a psychologist.
Yes.
And the New York Times had a special epithet for your mother. Do you know what I'm talking about her research? The godmother of infidelity research.
Yes. As she would say, not based on personal experience. Quick to say that, yes. She when she was getting her PhD at Catholic University in psychology, she started researching people's affairs by giving them questionnaires at the airport, and they would fill them out on the plane. And so she had this database that was about, like, did people cheat? were they happy in their marriages when they're cheating? One of her most interesting findings was that she was seeing a rise in the number of people who had happy marriages, but they still cheated. And she attributed it. These are a lot of people who were in a practice, and she did studies on this. And a lot of it was more men and women were working together with peers, and so they're spending hours together, and they would just fall in love with people. And people would say to her, like, I never saw myself as somebody who would cheat. Like, I'm happily married. Like, they weren't unhappy with their marriages. But then I kind of fell for this other person too, and we're together all day and this and that. And it led her to a whole theory about what to do to help marriages not make that happen, how to make marriages recover when that does happen. Like one of the things that was an innovation is that up until that time, if you had a marriage and it was falling apart and you went to a marriage therapist and you said, we want to stay together, the thing that they would interrogate you about is if somebody cheated, they would be like, well, what's wrong with your marriage? And you would totally focus on that. My mom said, like, well, actually for like over a third of these marriages, that's actually not the right question. They're happy. They're fine. There's nothing wrong with their marriage. The marriage is actually fine. And if you focus on that question, you're actually missing the thing that's really the thing you need to treat, which is the betrayal.
Interesting.
Somebody was lying to somebody.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So are you an only child?
My sister's sitting in the front row, so I'll say no. I have two sisters. Hey, Randy. Do you have any questions for her? She's sitting right there.
Randy.
We can just pass them back. Yeah.
So you went to...
I have an older sister and a younger sister. I'm a middle child, kind of a people
pleaser.
Oh, good.
I'm a middle. That's
yeah.
That's like... Okay. Mm-hmm. So you went ahead in public school in Baltimore?
Yeah, public school.
Then you go to Brown via Northwestern?
Yeah, I went to Northwestern for 2 years and then transferred to Brown.
And then you majored in something called semiotics.
Semiotics, yeah.
I looked it up. I still don't know what it is.
Semiotics is this kind of body of French narrative theory, literary theory, narrative theory. Like, the part that I studied was about, what semiotics is, it's this theory of signs. And literally it's like, how does meaning generated by different things? But the part of it that's really compelling, I think, for me anyway, is about how narrative works. And so I read a lot of Roland Barthes and people like that. And in contrast to like the way that like traditional literary theory goes, where if you remember like in high school, it's like, what are the themes of when you're studying a piece of work, a film or a book? It's about like, what are the themes of it? You know, what does it say about the author? What does it say about the author's time? Those are the questions you ask. Semiotics has no interest in that at all. What semiotics is interested in is how does this film or book or whatever, how does it pull you in? How does it sink its, how does it like get into you so you want to turn the page? And stay for the next minute and the next minute. Like, what is the machinery of it? And semiotics is also like has questions and has answers to, like, at the end of a really great movie or episode of TV or film, like, you know that feeling where you just feel like, ah, oh, that was so good. And then other times you don't feel it. They're like, well, what happened in the one where you feel it? Like literally, like, what's the machinery of the story that makes that happen? So that's what I studied in school and immediately started to try to put it to use in the stories I was making for the radio. And a lot of the structure of the stories and the way I think about the stories comes from that theory.
Wow. Interesting. So you are Jewish and you are atheist.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, you can't get rid of being a Jew. Like, you're just stuck with that. You know, like, it's, I think, is it Richard Rodriguez said, like, your ethnicity isn't like a suitcase you can lose at the airport, you know? Like you're sort of stuck with it. But I don't believe in God, so, you know. But, like, my sisters and I, we had, like, a fine Jewish Hebrew school education in addition to our public school education. We go 3 times a week and up through the 9th or 10th grade.
So tell me about Rabbi Seymour Esrog, because you said he had an influence and you're creating This American Life.
I mean, there are a bunch of things. Well, I mean, Rabbi Esrog, it's funny. It's only in retrospect that I realize, like, oh, yeah. But Rabbi Esrog, the structure of the stories that we tell on This American Life is there'll be an anecdote, that is, plot will move forward, and then there'll be some sort of thought about the plot, and then another anecdote, and then another thought. And so I sort of came to a conclusion that that's a good way to make radio stories, and And it's good if the story is sort of funny at the beginning and kind of sad at the end. And when I was growing up, there were two things in my life that did that. And one were Broadway musicals. Totally, I have that sort of like funny at the beginning, sad at the end. If you think of like a musical like Fiddler on the Roof, you know, like and pull you in with the characters and then like sort of drive at these bigger ideas about bigger things. But the other was the sermons that like this Rabbi Esrog was really entertaining speaker, so entertaining. I remember even as a child looking forward to the sermon. And you know, like the Jews, like the sermon can last for like 45 minutes. You know, like it's not like a 10-minute homily or something. Like whenever I go to like mass, I'm just shocked at like, wait, that's it? That's all you got to say? He's like barely even getting warmed up. You know what I mean? Like, but like, you know, like it would be like a 45-minute talk often, you know, and like then start off super funny and something you'd seen on television and he was talk about it and reminded, of course, bringing back to a passage from the Bible and whatever the passage is that week. And then in each sort of and the structure of the radio show is exactly the structure of a sermon. And once I started to make stories like that, like I don't know, I ended up realizing like, oh, this is might be why I'm so attracted to this form. I also remember being in Shul thinking to myself, man, that guy's got the job. That's such a good job. Get up there once a week.
Tell a story.
Tell a story. Do your thing.
It's great.
He was really good at his job. It was very moving, too. He really had a way of like bringing it around to something really moving at the end, which is hard when you're working with the Bible because those stories are so... Like, don't you find that like Bible stories are so like weirdly unsatisfying?
Yeah. Like scary, and
yeah,
not happy endings.
And God as a character is like such a weird. He's such a bastard in the Old Testament, and in the New Testament, he's like, what happened? He's all love. Like what? Like when did he change? Like what's his arc makes no sense. You know what I mean? They leave out, like, what were the transformational things that turned him from the God of wrath of the Old Testament, who's, like, telling Abraham to take his kid up on the mountain and just kill your kid to prove how much you like me.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, like, the book of Job, what kind of way is that to run a place? You know what I mean? But by the New Testament, like, he's just like, it seems like he's really done some thinking. I say with respect. Like... I'm just saying, it's a confusing book.
True.
And needs proper explication.
Okay, so to pick up on the confusion theme, Jewish, atheist, then for 12 years you're married to a Muslim woman.
Well, no, she was also an atheist. She was just, you know, her parents were Anahid's parents were, her dad was Muslim and her mom was Armenian Christian. So, but she didn't, you know, like they were way more Christian in her household because her mom was the greater dominating force.
Got it.
And both of her sisters actually still are believers.
Got it.
And you know, raised their kids in the faith. Whereas Anahi was very much like me. We were both atheists, good American atheists.
So, what is it about public radio? You started when you were 19.
Yeah.
Why? What's the draw for you?
Public? Well, when I was 19, it wasn't like I had anything else to do. Like, that was the place that I could talk my way into an internship. That was the attraction then.
All right.
Okay. And I had never heard of NPR when I started working there. It was just like I had a list of places to go, and I was like, well, nobody had. It was 1978. NPR only started in 1972. And so, like, it was tiny. Like, they didn't have a satellite yet. And so to hear, like, All Things Considered on KQED, literally it was sent through a phone line. Like before 1980, they didn't have a satellite till 1980. They were so small. Like, and if you would hear All Things Considered on KQED, it would be like somebody had taken the phone in Washington and held it up to the radio, and you were hearing it through their phone. Like, that's what it sounded like. And so it was very, very early days. Like, it was tiny. And so you could talk. I just talked my way into an internship. It was two floors of an office building on M Street.
Well, you are a talker.
I am a talker. And so, because it was so small at a very young age, by the time I was 19, 20, I was on the staff of All Things Considered, filling in, and then I had to choose whether I was going to go back to college. I took off time from college to work at All Things Considered. And I very much didn't want to go back. I felt like I was doing stories every day and, you know, producing things, and it was go on the radio out to a million people, which was the audience of All Things Considered at the time. But that's a lot of people. And my parents, it was one of the two times in my life where my parents just said, like, they pulled this move that is so smart, where they said, where they very much wanted me to go back to college. And they said this move where they said, don't do it for yourself. Don't do it because you think it's a good idea. Do it for us. They just basically said, like, I thought it was so smart. Like, it's very effective. They're like, look, we have not asked much of you. You know what I mean? Like, we raised you, cost a lot of money.
No,
like, we loved
trip.
You. We were good parents. And we actually have not demanded anything. And we're saying that you are going to do this for us as a personal favor to us. And that's going to be the reason that you do it. You don't have to think it's a good idea.
And?
That was persuasive.
And you did.
Yeah, and it was a good idea. I went semiotics as a result.
It is.
So they were right.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So I just wonder if you ever imagined that you would be the public radio titan. I mean, you've won every...
Those are three words that don't go together.
Yeah.
That's like being you're a titan of a little pond. You know what I mean? You're like a giant among the fleas.
At least a lake. But you've won just about every award you can get. You've appeared on Colbert Report, Jon Stewart's The Daily Show, and you were the voice on season 22, episode the High School Musical.
Simpsons. Yeah.
And if you made it on The Simpsons, you've made it. I mean, that's it, right? So, did you ever, it's like, this is what I want to be, and I'm going to...
No. This has worked out beyond all expectations, for sure. I just wanted to make something that would be special for me. Like, I don't know, when I started the radio show, Tori Malatia, who was my partner in starting the show, like, we thought like maybe it'll be popular, but the more likely thing that it seemed like it was going to be would be this would be a kind of show that some people would like, in the way people like an indie movie. You know what I mean? And it's just like, I know, as far as like, well, I like this, but like, if it stayed, like, as long, I just wanted to make a living from it, like, and not have to do a different job. And then the fact that it was popular was like a really pleasant surprise, but took years to happen. Like, it took us years to build an audience.
That's what I was going to ask you. How long did it take for it to really hit and to click?
It was slow because it took us 4 years to get to a million people listening a week, because you have to talk every single public radio station into picking up the show. Like public radio is part of what makes it, I think, so special, is that it's a radically decentralized system where there is a network NPR, but NPR only produces like a fourth of the shows that are on public radio. And, you know, and then you have Minnesota Public Radio making shows, and, you know, American Public Media, and just all these other groups making shows. And so anybody can make a show and just put it out on the internet, or before that on the public radio satellite, for like $100 an hour to get on the satellite. And so anybody can get a show, and you just have to talk the stations into picking you up. There's not like a network boss saying everybody runs the show at 2 o'clock on Tuesdays or something. And so once you talk people into it, they put it on. But then at the beginning, they don't trust you, so they don't put you on at good times. And so it took us 4 years to get to a million people per episode. With Serial, it took us 4 weeks to get to that. And then to show you how much times have changed, when we did the podcast S-Town, it took 4 days. And so, like, yeah, like, it's, so it's very, very different now.
Wow. So we have lots of questions.
Okay.
And I'm going to fire some at you now. Ira, when did you realize you had a radio voice? P.S. P.S. Did you take lessons in voice modulation?
I did not take lessons in voice modulation, and I don't practice it either. I don't even know what it is. It took me a long time to perform on the radio the way I do now. Like right now, I try to perform exactly like I speak, but that is not how I started. When I started, I sort of read like a person imitating an NPR reporter, but doing a bad job. And then it took years. And in fact, at one point, I started to do a live show on WBEZ with a friend on Friday nights, just to train myself to talk like myself live on the air. And so when I'm on the air, I have a script, but it's all designed for me to sound just like I'm talking. But it took years
to talk like yourself.
Yes, but I think that's not that uncommon thing. It's funny. Like I remember, I got a chance to interview the poet Billy Collins, and you know, like his writing is so him. Like you just can't mistake it for anybody. Like any great poet. And I said to him, like, when you started, what did you write like? And he says, well, I wrote like, he said, he knocked off beat poetry. And it just takes a while to, like, where you do it, where you imitate what you think is the official way to do it before you figure out your own way. And for me, I was 30, I think, before I really got it down. I started when I was 19. And so it took a while. And even then, like, I think that now, because I've been on the radio for so long, that now, like, people got used to this way of being on the radio, and in fact, like, all these podcasters have imitated it. But when we started the show, a common thing that we would hear from program directors is they would be like, well, Ira, you know, he was a good reporter on All Things Considered and all, but, like, are you going to get a host? You know, like, they wanted somebody with, like, a deep voice, like
Carl Castle.
Carl Castle, yeah, he just passed. Right. I was his newswriter for a while.
Really?
Yeah, I did the overnight. I was one of the newswriters for Carl.
Did you like him?
I loved it. Partly because when you write something for Carl Castle, it sounds so good. You know what I mean? Like you just learn... You learn to write for him, and it just sounds so real. You really feel like you're writing the news. Whereas when I write for myself, it just sounds like some guy, you know, like.
Now the question, what do you see as the future of podcasting?
I mean, I think the future of podcasting right now, the present of podcasting is that it's chaos, but it's kind of a happy chaos where I think Apple has like 500,000 active podcasts on iTunes, which is still the largest place that it's distributed, and I think that it's going to stay like chaos, and there's going to be tons of like podcasts that are just sort of two people talking amusingly or seriously about something that they care about, and that's going to be like a whole level of podcast, and those I feel like will always be kind of like sort of like a kind of niche product. That like people, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people like each one, and then I feel like the things that have been the biggest hits have been narrative, you know, like something like Serial or S Town. Like Serial, season one at this point has had 17 million people have downloaded every episode, which to give you a sense of scale, like that's the same number of people who watched the season finale of Game of Thrones last year. Do you know what I mean? Like it's like huge numbers, And I feel like our Julie Snyder, who produced Serial and S Town, like she said this. She's like, our theory is that podcasts can be television. Like if you think about the thing that's the most effective, most beloved thing in the culture right now, it's these TV shows that we binge watch, right? Yeah. And that's where I feel like most innovation is happening right now culturally. Just as pure cultural product is not really movies; it's TV. And these series and all this money is going in, all this talent is going in, people trying all these different things on television. But we feel like if you can do narrative with the same care that the best of those shows are, you'll get the same size audience. And I feel like we've shown that now a couple of times with different series. And you were saying before, like, where 2 million people listen to This American Life on the radio, but now 2.5 listen on the internet. Like in addition, you know, like it's more people listening on the internet. Than on the radio, and just so So that seems like a very exciting thing to happen. And honestly, one of the things that's been so interesting is to watch people sort of edge towards doing radio drama again, but doing it in a way that doesn't sound like the 1940s.
Like
but
the soap operas and on radio.
We haven't heard soap operas yet, but yeah.
Yeah, like on radio. I mean, back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah, back in the day. Yeah, but Gimlet did this show with Catherine Keener and Oscar Isaac last year. That was such an interesting experiment at it, and just it's going to be interesting to see if we go there too.
Interesting. Next question. My favorite This American Life is the 2-part series, The Problem We All Live With.
Yes.
Has there been any follow-up? So maybe you can fill us in a little bit about it. And then
The Problem We All Live With was inspired by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's this incredible reporter now at the New York Times. And basically, it's 2 episodes arguing a proposition. And the proposition that it argues is that the way that we've tried to fix... We have in this country a system of schools where... it's incredibly segregated, and there are still many, many schools in many, many cities. It's a common thing for there to be these schools which are all minority and all poverty. And Nicole was a reporter in the public schools for a while, and she kept going into these schools where she would see teachers bravely trying to make those schools into good schools, and doing all sorts of things, and charter schools, and this thing and that thing. And she came to the conclusion that those kids are so stressed out, and putting them together, in fact, studies confirm this, creates an environment which is very hard for all of them to achieve. And basically, Nicole said that we as a country actually already discovered what works, and that is integration. But nobody ever is talking about that as a possible solution to reintegrate schools. Basically, we started to integrate schools, and then at some year in the 1970s, I can't remember what year, but we say it in the story, we stopped and we started to resegregate again.
Right. And just going to add, our schools, public schools, are more segregated today than they were in 1968. So
okay, yeah, not a surprise. And what she said is that when integration happened, by the time it was at its height, very, very quickly, the achievement gap dropped in half, nationally, in half, the achievement gap between minority students and white students. And we weren't even fully integrated. We were just sort of like edging towards it. And there are all sorts of reasons why that is that we explain in the show. And we go to places and see it, and then we did the anchor story for one of those shows is this thing that Nicole does in Ferguson, where she goes to the high school that Michael Brown went to and that his mom went to, and she was really Nicole was really in caught by this thing that his mom said, which after he was shot, which was, "Do you know how hard it was to get him to graduate high school?" And then she basically told the history of that school that he was in and that school district, which was that it was completely segregated, like you would expect. And then during the period of integration, the schools were integrated, and that school was integrated, and it was a better school when his mom went there. So when his grandmother went there, it was segregated. When his mom went there, it was integrated. And now that he was there, it was segregated again. And then, because of a quirk in Missouri law, the school district, the entire school district was declared substandard, I can't remember what the word was. And because of that, those kids could transfer to another school district. And then we just followed the story of them doing that and the kind of results they got, including all the white parents in the school district that they were going to go to being really unhappy about it. Anyway, so the those 2 episodes, in a very full-throated way, try to make a case for, as a country, we should reintegrate the schools, and that it would solve a problem that we're not solving through any other means, that seems unsolvable through other means, and then looking for narrative, maybe tell a bunch of different stories, looking for narratives and characters and scenes that illustrate that and illustrate the problem and illustrate the solution.
So This American Life is storytelling.
Yes.
And from what you've just said, it's storytelling that has a goal to
sometimes
raise consciousness sometimes, right? So our question is, what do you view as the role of storytelling in this age of anxiety and divisiveness? Is it to give us hope?
That is so big, that question.
Find commonality?
That's a very grand question.
Yes.
I feel like we need dramatic music playing underneath us to answer that one. What's the role of storytelling in this divided times? I feel like, storytelling can do a bunch of things. Like, sometimes it's nice to have a story that's just super funny because, you know, everybody needs a break. And then often we find ourselves in a situation. There are all sorts of stories. There are all sorts of things happening in the world that none of us want to hear anything else about ever again in our lives. For example, the refugee situation in Europe. We're living in a moment where there have never been as many displaced people at any time since World War II. It's 60 million people around the world. It's a huge international tragedy, but I think most of us don't want to hear anything about it because it's sort of like, it's not complicated. You know what I mean? Like, you know how you feel about it. It's awful. It's people fleeing wars who end up in these refugee camps in Greece and
suffering. And,
yeah. And so I feel like one of the things that narrative lets you do is that once you get a story going, you can just start a plot going, and then people will listen just to hear what will happen. And then you can totally pull people in to listening to some aspect of what's happening, you know, in a refugee camp or in a part of the world that they might think they might not be interested in. And it could be funny, and there could be people, and so there's that too. And then I feel like stories in a very traditional way, like let ourselves into each other's lives.
Question. You clearly have mastered the art of telling a story. Do you have any inclination to turn your talents toward influencing how people think, such as entering the world of politics like Al Franken?
It's weird that sentence ended with Al Franken. I mean, I guess he's somebody who was like not in politics, who ended up in politics. There is a kind of a bigger example than that one, you know. I guess it was a Democrat writing that card. I mean, you know, it's my job to be politically neutral because I feel like I want to be able to get close to people on all sides of a thing and have them believe rightly that they'll get a fair shake from our show. That's not really answering your question. Hold on. Take two.
Is politics out of the question for you?
I think that I would be good at the public speaking part of it. Like, I feel like the breaking issues down into understandable bits and making somebody care, I feel like I've been preparing my whole life for that job. It's my understanding, however, there are other parts to the job of politics that perhaps I would be less suited for. And I don't know, like, if I'm going to be totally honest, like, I think like, anybody who has an audience, I don't even know about this, I can say, like, watching Al Franken and watching Donald Trump, the fact that like, wait, that guy can be president? Like, he has no political experience at all? Like, that's a thing that can happen? Like it does, I don't know, it's like, it's hard not to think about, like wanting to do something like that. But I think I would have no skills for it. It's like saying I want to perform surgery or something. Like, I would be really good at talking to the patient about what the operation was going to be like. I think all the other things that it would require. I would probably be good at the fundraising too. Public radio has taught me that.
Another question.
Yeah.
What podcasts, radio shows are you into right now? Easy question, but I just love hearing you.
Okay. The main podcast I would recommend right now to anybody is The Daily. It's 20 minutes long. New York Times puts it out. It's become completely defining for me. I listen to it every day. You can listen to it at double speed, which is nice. But what's great about it is they take whatever the top story is of the day, And then they retell it as narrative. Like, they'll go back and say, like, wait, what? Why is Korea doing this? Like, could you walk us through, like, what you – and they'll start at the – kind of start at the beginning. And I've heard the producer and the host of the show talk about this. And they're like, the New York Times assumes when you read the New York Times, you're kind of up on what's going on. They're just going to tell you the latest bit of the story. But they said they realized, like, actually, most people don't really know every bit of every story. And so it's nice to have a part of the newspaper, which now has a podcast, where they'll go back and do narrative. And it's I found it incredibly helpful. And sometimes they'll do something like the 2 days that Mark Zuckerberg was in front of Congress.
Yes.
Their reporters are so good. And the reporter who was there, like the first day, he just compared it to like a four-hour tech session for your grandparents when the Senate was like, you know what I mean? And he just, and they played amazing clips. And you're just like, he just cut to the heart of it. And then the second day, you know, I think the House noticed that everybody was making fun of the Senate. And the House kind of rose to the occasion a little bit. And, but even there, like just it's very quick, thoughtful analysis told by people who have very good taste about what would be interesting to say and what to address. It's just beautifully made. It's just beautifully made, beautifully edited, really smart. And it's lovely to have something that's like 20 minutes long and just like gives you exactly what you want to know. It's just a remarkable achievement.
Got it. I'm curious about your relationship with your cousin, Philip Glass. How well do you know each other? From what age? Did he have any effect on your career?
Okay, he had no effect on my career. Philip, my sister Randy was actually just saying, oh my God. Like, he was off becoming like one of the great composers of the 20th century when we were kids. We never met him. Like, did you ever meet him when we were kids? No. Yeah, he's our dad's age. He and my dad are first cousins, and they were close when they were kids. But Philip was off in New York. We didn't even know him. And then finally, I got to know him in my 40s, the first time I had a conversation with him, like I met him once backstage at a concert, and he was very gracious, but just like a stranger. And then the first time I actually had a real conversation with him was I had to get, you know, semi-famous first, and I was invited to interview him on stage in Chicago by the Field Museum. And so then that was the longest conversation we'd ever had. Was this conversation on stage. And then after that, whenever he would come through Chicago, which is where I was living at the time, he would kind of like call me up for dinner, and we would see each other. So I'd see him like once every couple of years. And then when I moved to New York, that's when which was 10 years ago, that's when I started to see him for real and got to know him and felt periods where I felt close to him. Like, but then we'll go through periods of like a couple of years where we'll barely see each other. And then generally the way we'll see each other is that he will be doing some sort of charity event and will call me to see if I will come out for it.
Of course.
But then it'll be really nice, and then we'll hang out.
That's good. Whenever things in life become hard to understand, I always hear Ira's voice narrating. Whose voice is narrating Ira's life?
Oprah, man, like anybody else. Who else? I don't have anybody narrating my life. There's enough narration in my life without somebody narrating my life.
You interview many people and have many shows. Do you find a similar characteristic between or among many of them? If so, do you think people need this trait or this characteristic? So is there anything you find, I guess, I'm going to kind of change the question.
Yeah, I'm not really sure I understand the question.
So there are shows you do where are there people, these are real folks, that you really like. I mean, there's something about them. It isn't about that their politics are the same as yours, but is there something about them? Is it
generally, I like most of the people who...
And why is that? I mean, what is it about them, I guess that's it, that you like, even though they maybe have different values than you have?
I find it really easy to like people who are different than me. Like, I don't know. Like people, I don't know. We live in a country of, like, really entertaining, funny, opinionated people, and I'm into that, you know? Like
you're a people person, or would you say you are or not?
I'm what my older sister would call a noisy introvert.
A noisy?
Which is, did you invent that?
phrase.
Yeah, she invented that phrase. Yeah, like it's sort of like I feel most at home when I'm alone. Like that's what I like the most.
Okay.
But in a crowd or at work or with other people, I'm a fake extrovert. If that makes sense. I and then I'm kind of a people pleaser. And then I don't know, like I think that one of the things about the radio show is like my feeling about people is like I pretty much accept them and like them. And so we're not so and the show itself, we don't come in like trying to, there's no cynicism to it. I feel like when we first went on the air, that was one of the things about it that was original. It wasn't cynical. We actually wanted to get to know people in an utterly sincere way and see things from their point of view. And I find that that is not that hard. And I find most people to be pretty likable, even when they're saying things to me that are just straight up, just not even close to being true, even when they believe stuff about President Obama being a Muslim, trying to impose Sharia law. And somehow very ineffective at that. That was his mission. You know what I mean? Like people say stuff that's so not true, but I still like them. And I don't know. I don't know why. Just how I'm built.
How has This American Life changed from its beginnings? How would you compare the early shows to what's happening now?
I mean, the early shows, like, we were way less newsy. Like, at the time, as a staff, we were less interested in that. And then we did a lot of, like, first-person stuff, a lot of stories about people and their families, a lot of stories that actually I don't think we would do now. Like it was very memoirish, but it was the 90s, mid-90s, and memoirs kind of hadn't peaked and the internet hadn't happened. Whereas now, that kind of introspection and that kind of, like, stories about people's families, like there would have to be just, like, a spectacular fact pattern to make it onto the show, people talking about their parents or their kids. And then at some point after 9/11, I and the rest of the staff, and I think a lot of the country, became just very, very interested in the news. And I feel like the radio show is best when it just kind of reflects what our interests are. And then since podcasting, we've had money, which we never had before, so we can send Zoe Chace to Washington for 4 months to be with Jeff Flake, or we can spend 5 months, whatever it was, 7 months in one Chicago high school that had 27 shootings. Or we can, you know, just we have the money to just, we, you know, our staff when we started was just four of us, and now it's a dozen. And so, like, people can spend months on a story, and just we never had the, that's all podcasting. Wow. That really is.
Are, like, you the decider?
I no. I mean, I guess in some ultimate way, but it never kind of comes to that. No, it's very much a group process.
So when is a time?
And in fact, like there have been now two or maybe three times when people were lobbying for stories that I was, like, absolutely against. And I was like, all right, let's try it. And then the stories won the Peabody Award.
Well, we've reached the point in our conversation here where there's time for only one last question. And I'm going to ask you this question. Episode 480. And can you just give us, we have 1 minute, just a teaser. It was the funniest one, and I'll just say the word piney.
Wait, you mean to talk about my dog?
It's episode 480.
Do you have a dog?
Part three.
That's the third act.
Act three.
Oh, you're doing this so well. Yeah.
So
keep going.
Can you just give us a teaser to close us out today? I thought it was hilarious.
Do you have a dog?
No.
This is a story that about the dog that my wife and I have had, who was kind of a problem dog. He was a pit bull because we're very tough people, and he's a pit bull because my wife had rescued another pit bull and thought they were misunderstood creatures, and they are, like, they could be very, very sweet generally if they're raised properly. But ours had behavior problems and issues that became clear when he was an adolescent. And so if we brought anybody into our house, he would try to kill them. and we were very, like, careful about training him. Like, we were good. My wife especially, just amazing dog trainer. Like, she trained him in a weekend to fetch her keys. Do you know there's a thing you could train a dog to do?
No.
Piney, fetch my keys. Where's my keys? And then he would go and find her keys and bring them to her. That was, like, 2 days of training. So we were, like, disciplined with him. But, like, he would totally And then he would wake me up in the middle of the night to go outside to pee, and we live in New York City, and so you put on clothes and go out into the street, and it's freezing, and then we would come back into the apartment, and as soon as we would walk back in, he would treat me like a stranger and like growl at me as I would try to get back to the bed, and I'd be like, dude, I just took you out. Like, do you remember, like... And then he had digestive problems, this thing called pancreatitis, which had shut his whole body down. He had allergies, so he was on allergy medicine. And did you know that there's like a meat-flavored Xanax? It's the same formula, but meat flavor for dogs. And then he needed a special diet, and so the vet just like, so his body won't completely shut down, and so because he would get allergic to the food, and so we would, it would be a protein and a starch, and so it would be like proteins you've heard of, like chicken and beef, but then like then after like 4 or 5 months he would get allergic to chicken, and so you move on to beef, and then you move on to pork, and then I remember when we switched to buffalo, and I was like, buffaloes even exist? I thought that was just like from ye old Westie days. I didn't realize that we still are raising buffaloes and feeding them to people. And then like at some point, like we had gone through like tofu and chickpeas and tuna fish from the can. And finally we're just like, okay, well, kangaroo. We have to like take the train out to Queens to this one store. 45-minute ride on the train with this purple meat, and you're just like, I don't know. And then there was a period where we were doing rabbits, and we'd go down to this old Italian butcher place in the village, Ottaminelli's, and you'd buy like, you know, $120 worth of rabbits, and the old Italian man behind the counter would be like, oh, you throwing a potty? You know what I mean? And then just someone would be like, oh, I'm the a-hole who's feeding this to his dog. You know what I mean? And like... other shoppers would be, how do you prepare that? And it's like, I don't even want to get into it. Anyway, so.
Thank you, Ira.
So, yeah, so that's, yeah, so, and then interestingly, that was a very, I think people heard that story on the radio and just hated me. Like really, I think because people just, it just made us seem, my wife and I seem like very fancy people that we would spend that much money on a dog. And it got a lot of negative reaction to that. That people were just like, well, I would not make that choice personally. And I hadn't, it was a weird, I don't mind saying personal things about myself on the radio, but that was one that was like the most divisive thing I've ever said on the radio. It's interesting, do you think of it as a funny story?
It was hilarious. And it was hilarious because your staff interviewed you and you were reciting this as if this was just normal, and your staff was like, "It's great."
Yeah, anyway. No, I kept saying, "What's the story? I don't see if there's a story here."
It's great. So, thank you, Ira. He should do stand up. I'm telling you. So, our thanks to Ira Glass, host and executive producer of This American Life, and producer of the new Netflix film Come Sunday. I'm Ladaris Cordell, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.